Log Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the Mary and Melissa Show. This is Melissa.
And this is Mary, and we are so happy to be broadcasting live from our nation's capital.
And together, because, you know, we've been apart for some time now. Our schedules have taken us in different directions. We've been doing shows solo, but today we are Dynamo Team again.
Exactly. Melissa realized she really couldn't live without me, and her solo act just wasn't the same without me. So thank you. And nor was mine. So
yeah.
Good to see your lovely blue eyes.
Yes, I'm
again.
Really happy to be back with you, Mary. So listen, I just got back from this trip to California. It's the first time I've actually taken a trip. Especially with my child. And I guess all you listeners out there know what it's like to take a long trip, a long meaning, you know, 10 days, with your special needs kid somewhere new, first plane ride, different sleeping accommodations, transitional issues arise when you move from one house to the next over the course of 10 days, and you're trying to kind of hit your favorite spots all at once, because you, the adult, have been kind of desperate to get out and want to make the most of it. But the little one doesn't seem to have the same kind of interest or strength to be able to take that hike or see this thing or watch that. Or they just want to kind of live in their video world or keep it mellow or... that's so boring, and it's taking too long, and, you know, the ADHD child has
it's overwhelming.
A lot of challenges on the road.
Well, I think one of that's so funny, because the other day, we drove into, my family, we drove into Manhattan, and we're like, oh, great, there it is, there's the hotel, and somehow this child, who misses a lot of things in life, in the corner of his eye, saw the NHL store as we whizzed down the street, and he caught in the middle, in his eye, and that's all he could talk about. So while we were unloading the car and getting into the hotel room, we were being pestered about the NHL store. And so in the middle of Manhattan, where we, you know, wanted to go see the Empire State Building, we wanted to go take a walking tour, we wound up, our first thing was spending an hour in the bloody NHL store. Anyway, so it is amazing how things get noticed and then things don't get noticed, and we find out a little bit more about them as we travel. So
yeah. It's true. We spent a lot of time in shoe stores.
Yeah, people go across country for that,
right.
I heard. Well, we have somebody with us today, Melissa, a very highly esteemed advocate for people with disabilities, an attorney, a lawyer, a friend to so many families, and his name is Brian Gruber. And he's actually from New York originally. He's from Long Island, which I kind of like that part about you.
Yeah, I can see why you chose him as a guest.
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, we just thought it would be fun to find out about what's behind the curtain of disability education law. Because, God, so many of us are just at the mercy of schools, and the only ammo often we feel that we have is turning to somebody like you, Brian, for counsel, for direction, and then ultimately for salvation for our kids. I mean, do you feel messianic sometimes?
Well, that's a great question, Mary, and thank you both to you and Melissa for having me. I think other than my mother, I don't think anyone has ever put me in messianic in the same sentence. Thank you for that.
It should happen more often.
And the answer is no, I don't feel particularly messianic about it. In fact, if you want to be more biblical about things, oftentimes I feel more as of Aaron, of the Moses and Aaron story, in that Moses had a speech impediment. And
he did? I didn't know.
Yes. This is one of the fascinating things. So,
what
so well, so if you read, if you read the Old Testament, and you read the story of Exodus, Moses had a speech And so Moses asks God to send his brother Aaron to function as his spokesman. And so I've equated it when the only one time prior to this that anybody has brought in the Bible into my conversation about what it is that I do. It's more the role of Aaron as giving the voice the individual with disability, but 100% of my practice is in representing children. So I really take great pride in giving children the voice.
Yes.
And by virtue
analogy.
Of giving children the voice is giving the parents the voice. And so I don't quite think that I get to part a sea, or shepherd a population from one place to the next. I like to empty my ocean one teaspoon at a time.
I just Googled
wow.
Moses and speech impediment, and I'm telling you, I mean, I went to Catholic school, and we learned everything.
I did too,
one, along with all the other things that they taught us in Catholic school, the other things, they never covered this. So I, again, you know, there's a lot of important things they missed, and this is interesting, and it reads, yes, that Moses said, I am slow in speech. So they think that he was a stutterer. Or maybe a stutterer or, had a speech impediment, which is all the same.
Maybe that's why they didn't take him so serious and they never thought he would amount to much.
Well, maybe that's why God wrote down the Ten Commandments, so he didn't have to read them.
The Red Sea.
Right, I don't know.
And he, people with disabilities do great things.
That's amazing.
And we all often overlook that. I love that analogy.
Yeah.
And here you are, I love that, the advocate.
Well, that's what we do. We try to give a voice to children and their families, particularly where, again, if we're going to go with this analogy, I wasn't expecting to, but it's great. It's oftentimes the school, similar to Pharaoh, is consistently saying no, 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 at what we think is a pretty reasonable request, and it falls on my lap to try to turn that no into a yes.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I love that. And especially from a mother's perspective, we have big voices, a lot of us, and we are frustrated that they don't listen to us and that we actually have to go out and find somebody else to tell them what we feel, to turn around and have them tell the school what we're already trying to tell them. And so...
Well, here's something that most parents don't think about. So, is that special education is a very jargon-rich work environment. And those special education, I often say, it's a language of its own. We talk, those of us who are in special education, who attend IEP meetings on a regular basis and who practice in this area, we talk in a shorthand. We talk about things like an IEP and a BIP and FAPE and a whole glossary of terms. Parents, it doesn't roll off your tongue. You don't always know this. And so, again, if we're talking in analogies, oftentimes parents will say, why is it that I need to involve a lawyer in special education? Why is there a role for a lawyer in special education? And it's not a whole lot different than if you think about, say, a real estate settlement, where when you're going to refinance your house,
right.
You'll be saddled with all kinds of different terms and terminology that you're not encountering on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And so the lawyer in a real estate settlement oftentimes is ensuring that the paperwork is in compliance and that the terminology is accurate. And again, that's one of the roles that we play as attorneys and advocates in special education. It really is its own language.
Yeah, and I appreciate that now, having gone through many processes and having finished graduate school where we had to learn what all those crazy words mean and the deep meaning behind those words. But I know there still is this nagging feeling of, this is my child's right to have a free public education, but it stops being free when I have to write checks to people in order to guarantee that. And that's the difference. Like, you don't have to go buy a house. The government doesn't say you have a right to have a house on that block. So I think that's the thing that really kind of, it's necessary, but it's so incredibly irksome and really strikes me at the heart of our democracy.
Mm-hmm, it does. And it seems like it's supposed to be your right. You know, like it's my right. My local school should be able to provide for my child in the way that I feel in the other people, the experts, the doctors, feel that he should be taken care of.
So let me correct your terminology a little bit, and then I'll try to add a little bit on that. So, Mary, you said that your child's right was to a free public education, and the right to a free public education is a fundamental civil right for all children that really came out of the desegregation of public schools in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education. For children with disabilities, it's an expanded civil right, not the right to a free public education, but the right to a free, appropriate public education, FAPE, as we discussed. Free meaning no cost to the parent, public education in simplest term, meaning that it's the same curriculum and state standards and implemented by the school system, but appropriate, that term that's in the middle, is a highly subjective term that, in its wisdom, the Supreme Court has told us we don't know what it is.
We as parents don't know what it is either,
and so you have this fundamental civil right. You have this right to a free, appropriate public education, but it's an undefined right, and so theoretically. There should be no role for what I do in public school. But if you think about special education as a civil right, if you understand that special education is a civil right, and if you understand that the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution says that the government cannot take away a citizen's fundamental civil rights without due process of the law, you start to understand that in order to enforce and in order to access your civil rights, sometimes you actually need to bring in legal expertise. And so, yes, the education that your children ultimately do receive is free, but ensuring that your version of what is appropriate and a school system's version of what is appropriate aren't always immediately reconciled. There's one other jumping-off point within that same line of thinking and conversation in terms of why should a parent have to go out of pocket to access something that technically is free. The Supreme Court, in the decision that I referenced before, it's called the Rowley case from, I think it's 1982, the Rowley decision where the Supreme Court decided to not define appropriate but gave us some parameters to work with, specifically said that the school's obligation to children with a disability is to provide an appropriate education, meaning an education that provides some educational benefit. And that's a very different standard than what any parent would want for their child. What any parent should want for their child is the best outcome.
Right.
And that's what the Rowley case was essentially about. The Rowley case was essentially about parents who believed that providing certain interventions, in this case, it was an interpreter, because Amy Rowley, the subject of the case, was a young lady with a hearing impairment, that providing the interpreter would enable her to achieve her best possible outcome. And what the Supreme Court told us a couple generations back is that that's not what this law is about. This law is about access. This law is about providing a basic floor of opportunity to provide an education that meets your child's disability and enables them to make some educational benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? No parent wants some educational benefit. Parents want best. So you have a law. So this is a long way to answer your question about why should a parent be going out of pocket to try to secure something that on its base is free. But what we have in this well-intentioned law is a law that on its face sets up a conflict between the end recipient, being the parent and the child, and the provider of that obligation, which are public schools.
Brian mentioned this to me a few times, and I still can barely stomach it.
Right.
So
I just can't believe that I never realized that appropriate pretty much meant some educational benefit. Well, that pretty much takes them off the hook on just about all levels, because some is just basic.
Some is some.
Yeah. And,
it's,
you know,
it's a low bar.
When I first started this process and first grade came along, well, kindergarten, it starts in kindergarten for me, I was one of those parents that really wanted the high and was seeking and pushing for the best, because I knew he needed it, and I knew he needed it. Well, you know, somewhere along third grade, I just settled in my mind and knew my child well enough to say, you know, I'm not so concerned about the academics anymore, because I could see that that's going to be a slower, longer process, and he's going to need a lot more assistance than what I'm getting or can get. And so I've begun to feel more comfortable with the some educational benefit, because I know that he's getting just enough and that we're working on other bigger issues. You know, self-hygiene is a huge issue we're still working on. Social interactions and stuff like that on the home front for me. And I see that the academics are hard for him and that the school really gives a lot more than he can handle. So I'm comfortable with that. Guess what's been happening? The other side of the circle where the school wants more than what we can give or that he can do in their structure.
Right.
And now I have this reverse issue where I'm trying to say, hey, I'm good with him. You know, I've never seen him this happy. I think he's socially adapted and doing really well, and he's getting the basics, and I would appreciate less pressure. But if you want him to be more, learn more, then you have to put more. And that's where my new dilemma.
Yeah.
He has gone through this in so many different levels and cycles that now this is a whole new interpretation of what is some educational benefit. What is appropriate for him is not so much.
Well, I mean, I don't know, Melissa. I mean, I'll play devil's advocate here because counselors steer me in the right direction here. But when I hear you telling us what the Supreme Court says, I have to think, okay, well, say if we had to talk about women and women's civil rights, should it be just some appropriate access to, I don't know, to voting? Like I'm trying to make a parallel, or with African Americans, and you know, should just there have been some appropriate way to ensure, you know, voting rights? And so I'm wondering why this minority is not more, does not have a more ironclad route to the freedom land.
So let's try to put that in some context there, Mary, because
okay.
I don't know that public education is the freedom land.
It is for a lot of us.
That's a very interesting specification.
Yeah, it is. It's Thomas Jefferson thought so.
Because private school, then we're talking a whole different...
Private school is a pretty quick conversation. So let me ask Mary, and then we'll do yours.
I like that.
Okay?
I like that.
So I'll service Mary first, and then we'll take on Melissa.
Excellent.
Okay, busy day for me.
I know.
So here we go.
I'm
okay.
Sorry, you know.
All right. So anyway, so the quick history lesson is that prior to 1954, we had segregated public schools in parts of this country. And what the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education did was say that separate but equal was not acceptable.
Right.
Okay, we all went to high school, we all learned
about that.
We all learned about that. Separate but equal was not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the backdrop for this law. Now, fast forward a generation from 1954 to 1975.
Mm-hmm.
In those 20 years or so, Congress became very aware, through some really great grassroots advocacy, Congress became very aware that in parts of the country, including right here in the District of Columbia, kids with significant disabilities were being segregated from public school.
Mm-hmm.
In parts of D.C., and Philadelphia, some other major population centers, kids were being sent to warehouses to string beads together, and that was being called education.
Okay.
And so when Congress passed what is the predecessor to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, our nation's special education, about to provide a basic floor of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the analogy that's often used, in fact, it's in a lot of literature and some of the statutes and the court decisions, is that Brown versus Board of Education opened the schoolhouse doors for all kids.
Mm-hmm.
What the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, does is provide those kids with a basic floor of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I love the analogy because if you imagine, say, an elevator door opening and there is no floor, what will happen once you step in?
Right.
But if you put in that floor, if you put in those basic supports through an IEP that is reasonably calculated, tack on two pieces of language. An appropriate IEP needs to provide sufficient support to enable that child to make some educational progress.
Mm-hmm.
And that it needs to be reasonably calculated to provide some educational benefit. Okay? Again, putting in that basic floor of opportunity, hopefully, levels the playing field to enable the child with a disability to access his program.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
This entire law was set up to provide that access to public school, which is why I can now shift to Melissa's question about private school and answer it really quickly. Private schools, with one exception, do not have to follow any special education law. The one exception is for private schools that accept federal funds.
Right.
If a private school accepts federal funds, then they have an obligation to implement what's known as a 504 plan, which again is an access plan for children who have disabilities that cause a substantial impairment.
Right.
But private schools do not have to implement an IEP, an individualized education program. They are not bound by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Now, I'm going to draw a distinction between private schools that are purely private and private schools that we sometimes refer to with the term non-public. And when we talk about non-public schools, we talk about schools that are special education environments who operate as an extension of the public school for the purpose of implementing a child's IEP. And those schools, again, for students who are placed there by public schools, have the obligation of implementing the child's IEP, providing the services. But if they're not doing their job, if they're not following the law, if they're not compliant, the entity in which parents have to take up their grievance is the public school agency, not the private school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a quick conversation about private schools.
Sure.
We don't play with private schools.
Right.
They're not responsible. And every year I get a bunch of phone calls from parents whose children are in Saint Somebody.
Uh-huh.
You both mentioned Catholic schools, so I'll pick on them.
We'll
get calls from my child's in Saint Somebody and this is happening or this is not happening and I can't help you.
Yeah. But I've heard stories of people with children in Catholic schools who do get lawyers and their children do get placements in schools that have a special program.
So you're talking apples and oranges. The Catholic school, the private school, is not responsible for providing those services. The public school agency for the jurisdiction where the child lives is responsible for doing two things. One is to locate and identify all children who live within the school district who may be in need of special education, and once identified, need to offer them what we call a FAPE, free appropriate public education. So there are scenarios. And by the way, I won this case in United States District Court in the District of Columbia. So this is an area that I know quite a bit about.
Okay.
But it is the responsibility of the school system to identify these kids, and once they know about them, to offer them an IEP. So a scenario that I'll make up just for illustration is a child could be parentally placed at St. Somebody not doing well academically despite all the interventions and the small classes and some degree of special support that the school is able to give. The child is just not able to read. That school can contact the public school agency for, you know, for that county or that city, or ask the parents to do it and say, you know what, I think that Anthony has a learning disability and we think he needs some services. And that school system then needs to meet with Anthony's parents to talk about their concerns. If there is reason to suspect a disability, the school system has to evaluate that child in all areas of disability at no cost to the parent. They have to meet with the parent to review the results of those assessments and determine if, based on state standards, that child meets the standard as a child with a disability. And if they do, then within 30 days of that determination, they have to meet with the parents again to develop an IEP, an individualized education program, that will provide the child with an appropriate education. The parents then can determine to access it or not access it. But if the parents and the school system have a disagreement about that, what constitutes a free, appropriate public education from that offering, the parents have some legal rights. And so it does happen sometimes that children go from being in a private school to being in a highly specialized special education school at school system expense. Again, based on very unique circumstances related to the nature and severity of the child's disability.
It is such a labyrinth. God, you know, I feel like I've been in this business for a long time now, but
yeah.
I'm still
learning,
you know,
something new.
I'm still learning something new, and it's, I just remember my early days going through all of this, and I've heard this from a number of other parents, where you come out of your first IEP meeting and you go, okay, wait a minute. You know, I went to college, you know, maybe I've got some graduate school, you know, I've held down a job, I've had lots of meetings with important people, you know, but those people in that room made me feel like an idiot, and I don't know what I'm doing, and this is an alternate universe, and I think that's just one of these things that, I don't know how we all can fix it, but you really are given a ticket, you have no choice. But you're given this ticket, and you got to enter into this, this ride, where all the rules are, you've never heard about them before, and all the acronyms, and it's really tricky. And you're right, you know, you're right. That's why we wind up going to attorneys. But I guess that's the thing that just sort of is a scarring experience.
It is. It changes your entire school experience from the start.
I mean, it does get us to meet lovely individuals such as yourself, you know, and that's a positive. But but it is kind of like, you know, you wind up managing more than you expected, and so that's whatever. It's an interesting.
In some cases, it puts you in the different section, so to speak, where there are parents at schools who don't want to do anything, and they know that their child needs it.
Mm-hmm.
And the teachers know it, and the parent knows it, but to pursue the legal process is going to change your relationship with the school. They're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid to rock that boat. There's many reasons why they're afraid. But from my perspective, they're not helping to create an atmosphere where the school is forced to do more, because they're not willing to be more vocal about it.
So one of the perceptions that I often try to change and talk about quite a bit is this concept that hiring a lawyer has to reflect an adversarial position.
And it usually does.
I disagree with that. I think that on TV, lawyers are portrayed as being adversarial, and many, regrettably, in my line of work are adversarial in nature, but many fields of law are not immediately adversarial. And I'm going to go back to the analogy that I used before about buying a house. When we refinanced our house recently, there was a settlement attorney who handled all the paperwork. There was nothing adversarial. The mortgage company was happy to lend me more money than I can afford. And my wife and I were more than happy enough to sign papers, promising to make payments that we only hope we can make. But there was nothing adversarial about it at all, yet there was still a lawyer in the room who collected a fee. Not every situation that involves a lawyer necessarily makes things adversarial. Going back to what Mary said before, there is a language to special education. And if you don't speak the language of special education, you can't expect that you are going to be an equal participant with the school team. But I agree with you, Melissa, that it is for many parents, it's very intimidating. For many parents, you want desperately to trust what the educators in the room are telling you. I mean, they went into education with a desire to work with kids. They certainly didn't go into it for the pay. They went into education because hopefully they had a great desire to work with kids. Many, many educators, far more than not, are dedicated to their profession, put in tons of hours that they're not paid for. I speak at conferences all the time. I have educators in my group that are there on their own dime that, you know, talk to me about training programs that they can access through my office at their expense, and opportunities to come and talk to them. So, teachers want parents to understand. They want parents to understand the impact of the child's disability. They desperately want this. They desperately want this to work, but it is a system that is really set up with conflict, but also with difficulty in terms of communication. There was a recent study done by the United States Department of Education that most special education paperwork is written on an 11th grade level, reading level. The most parents of special education students read on a 6th grade reading level.
That ain't right. That ain't right. That ain't right. Hold on. Just what you mean, Melissa?
Sit down, you're rocking the boat.
Is that what you've heard people say?
That's what they're afraid of, but I was in that play, and I'm not afraid to rock that boat.
Well, all right,
but there's a difference.
Yeah.
Some people don't want to rock the boat, and some people don't trust the educators, and sometimes with good reason.
Mm-hmm.
There are some educators out there, there's maybe not making a lot of money, but they've gotten out of date.
Mm-hmm.
Or they think they know it all. Or they feel like I don't see a problem.
But what's the sixth grade thing you're throwing out there? That they write at a sixth grade level?
No, most.
The parents are.
Parents of special education students on a national level read at approximately a sixth grade level.
And then the special education teachers write at an 11th grade level.
The paperwork that comes with special education is typically written at an 11th grade level.
You have
a disconnect between what the parents can understand and what the school is attempting to communicate.
I thought you were trying to say that special educators were deficient in their abilities.
I would never say that as a whole population. Now, I've known many special educators over time who were deficient, and that's unfortunately why I got to know them. But I have a great respect for educators. I'm married to an educator. Both of my parents in their careers were educators. My children attended public school. So I would not disparage an entire population of professionals. And I have a son who's in a teacher's college at Arizona State.
I just thought you were quoting some stats. That's good. Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay, but that still leaves us with this barrier between trust and understanding between parents and teachers. And why is it the parent has to go that far? And back to my trip to California, I noticed that schools there are structured differently, and they're public, so So isn't this a national?
But, yeah, I mean, and I'm sorry. Like, I've read Kant, you know. I've read Hegel. But I could not understand why they were talking about a three-year-old getting occupational therapy. I just sat there and I'm like, what in God's green earth are you talking about? My little boy has to go to occupational therapy because he doesn't know how to have a – it made no sense. Because
well,
I didn't understand it.
Yeah, but I understood it.
Well, okay.
But
well,
that's
because you're maybe at a 12th grade level.
Background.
Okay,
I
studied political theory.
Right.
So, you know, so just the fundamentals.
Oh, that's interesting. It's a good
yeah.
perspective
yeah.
because I studied brain function and developmental
yeah.
behavior.
Yeah.
And so I understood his needs.
I just wanted my son to be a Marxist. And
then
they're talking about him, occupational therapy, and I was all upset.
So let me tell you a story. I tell the story a lot, and I'll try to keep it as narrow as possible. I graduated first in my law school class.
Woo!
Okay.
Where'd you go?
Cool.
It doesn't matter.
I went to
it was online.
The University of my mom. I went to the District of Columbia School of Law. I graduated first in my law school class. Now, that's not the important part of the story. The important part of the story is that I had to completely renovate a bathroom in my old house because I attempted to change the flapper in a toilet that was running.
Yeah.
And the quick story on it was that the toilet was running. It was in our powder room. It was an old house. It was the original plumbing. And I was at an intersection in Charles County, Maryland, where there was a Walmart, a Lowe's, and a Home Depot all at the same corner, and I was feeling pretty brave, and I went into one of those stores, and I bought everything off the shelf, and I came home on a Saturday afternoon, I lifted that toilet tank to start changing the flapper, and the first clue that I was out of my element should have been that the inside of the toilet didn't look like anything that from the replacement parts that I had. Okay, but I said I graduated first in my law school class. I'm a bright enough guy. I went to college, Mary. I should know this. I should know how to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. Following my analogy. Right.
Yeah.
I'm a guy. Exactly. So I went I saw on one of the pipes there it said turn to remove. So I turned to remove, and the next thing I know, water is splashing up hitting the ceiling. So I figured out now that I've got to shut the valve down. But the pipe came off in my hand. So now I have to get under the toilet now to try to with a wrench to try to take out this 70-year-old pipe, and in the process I cracked the toilet.
Oh,
so now a plumber had to come and replace the toilet. When he did, because this was the original plumbing, the flooring had been cut around where that toilet was, and the new toilet didn't match that. So what was exposed was the subfloor. And a couple of years later, when we sold the house, the real estate agent came in for the before we put the house on the market, took a look at that powder room, and said, before you can put this house on the market at this price, you've got to retile this bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to retile an entire bathroom because I attempted to change the flapper. The point of – but I graduated first in my law school class, so I must have something to work with.
Something.
So, Mary,
it's the same as
what you're talking about. When you're talking about you have all of these skills, all of this knowledge,
you
have all of these strengths, but when it came to understanding occupational therapy in a three-year-old in that role, this is an area of deficit for you because you don't have the exposure and the expertise and the training.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's one of the roles that we play in my practice on a regular basis. We have a term that it's going to be rolling out on our updated website and social media that's educate, collaborate, and advocate.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the three terms that we try to do every day. I always want to try to educate parents in terms of what their rights are, what the terminology means, what the impact of their disability is. I have a new partner in my practice who's both a special educator as well as an attorney, so we have a really great collaborative background approach. Collaboration is the second major prong in what we do. We're not looking to rock your boat. We're not looking to go to war over every situation. We're looking to collaborate with the school because we're talking about children. We're talking about parents. We're talking about educators. Everybody's in this invested in it for the same purposes, and we always want to try to collaborate. But the third prong is important, and that's advocate. We're always trying to be agents of change, to improve the situation for the child, for the parent, for the school. And there are times when we have to be adversarial in terms of the advocacy, but that's never the starting point. The starting point is always back at the education and the collaboration.
Beautiful. I love that. Really.
I think Moses, I mean, that's like the three commandments for special education, disability advocacy, educate, collaborate, advocate.
It is. It summarizes the entire process, you know, educating both the child and the parent.
And sometimes the school.
And the school.
And sometimes the school.
Yeah. And then it has to be collaborative. Many times it's not. And unfortunately, when the parent sometimes chooses to take this path of bringing in the lawyer because they are not feeling that there is enough collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Because the school's FAPE decides that it's really this minimal amount of collaboration that I'm really responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
And the parent really feels like, no, I really need you to be handling this and this and this. And then you're forced to feel like, well, wait a minute, I feel like there's disagreement here. Let's bring the big guns in. And that's where you see the lawyers come in. And then you end up advocating on both ends, and hopefully you have a positive resolution for both sides. But sometimes it's an ongoing battle. When does it end? Where, you know, why is it there can't be more peace?
Mm.
Otherwise, we wouldn't need the services of lawyers so continuously.
Don't you think the answer is if you tune in next week, you'll find out the answer?
Yes, actually, that's exactly how it sounds.
What Dr. Doolittle says.
Well, I would love it if there was a magic pill that you know, or a magic wand that could bring everybody onto the same page. You mentioned, Melissa, before having been out in California and seeing a different setup in terms of school districts, and I've had the opportunity to work on cases in multiple states, multiple parts of the country. In some areas, school districts are as small as townships with one high school, and in others, they are as large as counties with dozens of school high schools and hundreds of total schools. The law is the same. It's federal law. The law is the same. The way it's implemented in some areas is better than others. Some school districts embrace collaboration more so than others. Some areas have higher levels of trust. Some areas have higher level of parental demands, but I was just out in California as well, participating in an IEP meeting where, again, it was collaborative, but there were definitely some of the same kinds of deficits that we see back here on the East Coast. And while I was out there, there was a group of teachers that wanted to talk to me about professional development and about giving them some additional support from the district. So as I said before, I think that unfortunately, the law is set up to conflict with what parents want, but I also believe that the same conflict belongs with teachers. That I don't know any teacher who is interested in seeing their students only make some educational progress. Teachers want to see the benefit of their labors. They want to see kids make
I think I've met, I may have met a few. I mean, I'm not won't quote, but, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're talking to the wrong.
No, you're talking to the exactly right people.
My experience has been that most teachers, and some of them are too young to really understand, and then the ones that have been there too long are just too tired to care.
But you're right.
And so what you want to do, Melissa, is come pay me a visit, and we can talk more about your kid and change that, because that's an unfortunate situation, and that's something that really should change. But that, again, I can only empty my ocean with a teaspoon at a time.
I love that.
That
is so great.
So how did you come up with that?
Well,
I don't know.
I've been
using that for as many years as I can remember. I don't think I created it. I think I heard it from somebody and liked it.
But it ties in with my messianic comment and then the Moses thing.
I don't know. It must be that time of the year.
It also
ties in with the whole special education language. And that is a great way.
That just
shows what a successful lawyer you are, because you bridge the gap so easily, and you're making me feel right now very comfortable and more educated, and that working with you is going to be collaborative.
That's what we try to do within our practice. When I have the opportunity to mentor or train other attorneys, again, that's the philosophy that we try to bring. Again, you know, educate, collaborate, and advocate. Those are the three pillars. That's what we try to do.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of takeaways from this conversation, but perhaps the most powerful one is now I know when Charlton Heston stood on that mountain, why the Shazam came and wrote the Ten Commandments.
Instead of him writing it, or him having to write it
and be dictated, and the speech impediment. I mean, just that kind of makes a lot more sense.
I think it's the ultimate assistive technology.
Oh my God! The first assistive
technology. I mean, you don't get better than that.
Who invented it? It was Yahweh.
No, for me, it's that Moses had a disability is just blunt mind blowing. I can't believe that, and it's written there. And how did I overlook that? But that, and then parting the sea and the great things that he did, just brings back to us the fact that people with disabilities deserve all the love and advocacy that we can give them, because
they're badasses.
They're gifted, and that societal perspective on that has to shift. And that's another thing that you lawyers do, is help to pull that change in society, that these people deserve the advocacy.
These people, because it's us.
Right.
Okay.
People meaning.
Yeah, all of us. Yeah,
included.
Give me your
Girl.
All right.
Well, Melissa, let me just point out, because you make an excellent point, and one of the most overlooked features within any IEP is a requirement to consider the individual strengths, interests, and attributes of a child. So when an IEP is being developed, there really is the need to put some thought into. We talk oftentimes in education about teaching to the strengths, knowing and understanding, what makes this child special. Seeing the child and not just the function of the disability. Everybody brings a different set of strengths and weaknesses to the table. So similar to my story before, graduating in law school and being in a profession that demands that I use my brain to make a living resulted in me having to use those dollars to pay somebody who makes a living with doing something mechanical,
right,
and changing my toilet. Mm-hmm. They're not interchangeable skills. There's a role for me. There's a role for him. And everybody's going to come to the table with something else to bring.
To every season, turn.
And while we're quoting, I'd like to end our talk today with a wonderful quote from John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Leadership and learning are indispensable to each other.
That's great.
Yeah, leadership.
And he had
learning.
A disability too, by the way.
He had a disability.
Right.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. So we are, nurturing our future leaders who are gifted.
Absolutely.
Well, Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Great. We look forward to having you again.
I hope you'll invite me.
If we have something else to talk about.
I don't know. I think we covered everything. We've got a few more prophets in the Bible we could refer to, I think.
Well, you sound like the rest of my family. No one wants to hear me speak any further.
I just said yes. No, we're good. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Mary Melissa Show, a fabulous project of Inclusion Zone. And
tune in real soon, because we're going to be starting a new series of parent talks, where parents can call in and share their perspectives, feelings, and frustration.
Okay, and make sure that make sure you do rock the boat, but here's the song.